Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Welcome to this bonus episode of Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Kot. My co-host is Jim DeRogatis. And if you want to be the first to hear our bonus podcasts, become a Sound Opinions member on Patreon like Theo Polly. Thanks for your support, Theo. Recently, Jim, you had a conversation with Professor Tim McHenry about why people largely stop listening to music as they get older.
That's absolutely right, Greg. Go back to episode 917 if you missed the beginning of the conversation, but the continued discussion comes in just a minute on Sound Opinions, and I think it's critical. How many peers in our age group, Greg, just haven't listened to anything in 30 years? It always kills me. Why? Why?
I hear you. We're going to have some answers for you.
Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island has been brewing award-winning beers in Chicago that are inspired by this city. Take 312 Lemonade Shandy, Tropical Beer Hug Double IPA, and a rotating series of hazy IPAs only available in Chicago. You know, every time we go down to Goose Island, there's another one that they're pushing on us.
That's right.
They're all good.
Absolutely. And what supporters of musical culture, you know, in the city of Chicago and elsewhere, if you go to a show in Chicago and you see that Goose Island sign, you know you're in good hands. They're music fans as well as great beer makers at Goose Island, so we're really proud to be associated with them.
The Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer.
Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island's been brewing beers in the spirit of Chicago.
You can find IPAs, Lemonade Shandy, and limited releases in-store or at one of Goose's venues in Chicago. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer.
We're back. Take it away, Jim.
Well, and we interviewed another scientist who was talking about, I mean, there's ongoing study about why certain pop songs become hits, right? And down to the point of certain melodies, certain keys, certain repetitive refrain. I mean, you know, they trigger that dopamine, whether it's Beatles or K-pop. It works.
That's right. And look, you know, you just have to observe, I guess, two, you know, broad practices. One is music and advertising, where, look, the music is serving a purpose there. I'm not speaking judgmentally. I'm just saying what is needed is music that fits into a particular vibe or demographic. And the makers of that music will be quite forensic in terms of, we don't want to breach copyright. And we don't want to pay a lot of money, yet we do want to capture the specific sound world at play. And utterly forensic in making stylistic choices that generate that sound. Likewise, if you think about music theatre in many instances has often been a reflection of popular music practices of 20 years of the past. Andrew Lloyd Webber definitely does that. Yeah. People have used disparaging language to describe him. I don't think the disparaging language is helpful. I think the descriptive language, which he is trying to capture diverse styles in order to inhabit particular sound worlds. And that's often true of people who search after hits. The concept of a hit seems to be a combination of what a culture values in terms of music style and practice, which operates cyclically.
Yeah.
Against sort of more robust affect that we know work. And I love this topic. I really do, because this is where I live. You know, the human voice works in a particular way. And mm-hmm. when a belting voice sits in a particular part, it's mimicking a cry. It's mimicking almost a groan. And mm-hmm. there is a physiological, emotional reaction that ties to that. Using tempo just above the heart rate, mm-hmm. perfect, to get the heart rate higher. So there are definite connections. But on the other hand of it, you mentioned hip-hop, and it's focus is rhythm.
Right.
You go back to 70s music like Chicago, and gosh, the harmony is so rich. Mm-hmm. Nothing like a song of today. And so people often look at their musical taste and say, oh, it's not as good as it used to be. No, it's changed, and it changes cyclically.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm convinced that harmony will be back in 10, 20, 30 years.
Oh, and well, what listen to the K-pop bands, the boy bands. Yeah, of course.
Indeed, that there is harmony that is rich. I mean, in terms of chromaticism and extended phrytic language and jazz harmony, that'll come back in some form. It won't sound like jazz, but it'll come back in. You know, Leader doesn't sound like jazz, but gosh, they have a lot of chords in common.
I was thinking about what you were saying about we know within seconds. And I think one of the things Greg and I have trained ourselves to do is to listen past that initial reaction, right? I mean, I, for one, hate the ukulele, okay? Just hate it. Despise it, okay? It bothers me. You know, it's fingernails on the chalkboard. And yet I listen to Tune Yards. And, you know, Merrill Garbus is brilliant. I think as a music critic, you have to be so broad in your interest. I hate polka music. You know, it's like, look, I could take you to see some 85-year-old guys on the northwest side of Chicago who rock harder than any band you can name, you know. And there will be some accordion and some polka that you like, right?
Yeah.
If you get past that knee-jerk reaction. But the best part of your article, Tim, is you give us a list of how to keep up. For those people who, obviously, one of the things about aging is you just don't have the time anymore that you had when you were an adolescent. You note that. And maybe your taste is set and you no longer define yourself. You know what you like. You don't have it. How do you keep up with new music? Well, you can listen to Sound Opinions. And we cover the waterfront, you know, from Iggy Pop to Kila, right? But how to keep up. And you have this list. So we wanted to take you through it. Number one, you cultivate different modes of listening. So formal, concerts, focused, solitary listening on your own, casual while you're making dinner, social settings, you put something on at the party. Why is that important?
What the research reveals is that the more modes of listening you have available to you and you have systematically incorporated into your life, the more robust and diverse your musical taste is likely to be. That if your listening is very narrow, that's when you get the phenomenon of there are these sort of old favorites I like and nothing else. Mm-hmm. So if sort of music is on in the background, if, you know, participatory music is part of the landscape, if you are systematically going to concerts, and it might be that the going to the concert is as much about being with friends mm-hmm. and having a restaurant meal beforehand, these things work together to sort of just automatically expose you to different sorts of music. And because familiarity is at play, those additional modes just make the whole system stronger.
Number two was making listening habitual. You mentioned put on the earbuds while you're taking your walk in the morning. Listen to podcasts, listen to music.
That's it. I mean, in about every human activity, as we age, our tendency to want to try new things diminishes. Again, it's not the story of an individual. That's the story of, mm-hmm. you know, people. But habit is a great way to stand against that, and good, useful habits where we say, okay, I've got my podcasts I listen to. I've got, you know, the news that I want to catch up with. But Mondays and Wednesdays, those are my music days. I am mm-hmm. going to take suggestions from my Spotify, or I'm going to, you know, work through the back catalogue of a musician I discovered and I've not listened to everything, or some kind of deliberate, I will explore more. And you mm-hmm. systematize it, because our lives are busy, and the time we have as children, you know, I think certainly it's been my experience, and I'm sure it's your experience, if you're not deliberate about it, it's hard to make it happen.
It's true. Be curious about what you're listening to. I love this one, and I'm sure Greg does as well. You can help your brain form new patterns by knowing something of the story behind the music. Context is everything, right?
It is, yeah. And you're quite right. I mean, you know, listening to a podcast like this absolutely helps because, you know, simply listening to sound and saying, I am listening to a new piece of music or a new genre that I'm not otherwise familiar with, it's hard to lock that in to the sort of storehouse of memories and understanding. Think about what we did when listening as teenagers, or I think I did, and I think many of us did. The listening was accompanied by learning about what we were listening to, by looking at track lists, by comparing that to other material, by sort of creating timelines of, I could take you through exactly what songs, in what album, in what order, in what year. I couldn't do that with a lot of the more recent repertoire, but that was what I was doing as an adolescent, and that memories, those memories are still with me. So if you can understand where's the genre from, what geography, how does it fit together, when did they form, this information just helps lock our understanding in, and it can be interesting, and that drives the connection.
Be patient and persistent. Don't assume because you immediately don't like a piece of unfamiliar music that it's not worth listening to. The more you listen, the better your brain will be at triggering a pleasure response.
And I think my flowery language was captured so much more effectively by you when you said, you know, train yourself to listen past the first 10 seconds. But I also observe it from making music and studying and researching the thing that is music. Mm-hmm. Music relies on patterns. Our brains are pattern recognizing machines. And when we don't recognize the patterns, it requires a little bit more work. Mm-hmm. And if our brains are set up to expect pleasure, but instead the music says, well, no, it's a bit of work for you, then, you know, it's not, I wasn't wanting work, I was wanting pleasure. And that disconnect means we mightn't want to do it, but that's not a judgment about like or dislike. That's a reaction. Now, here's the thing. If we come across a piece of music that we have not heard before, but we immediately like it, I think we should entertain the possibility that there is something in that music in terms of the patterns, structures, harmonies, sounds that it uses, that articulates with music you already know. And gosh, you learn a lot about yourself if you can analytically say, I love that. Why?
Yeah. If it's, you know, if it sounds like Piper at the Gates of Dawn by Pink Floyd, I'm going to like it. But that's also bad, you know?
I think it's not bad, but it's revealing. Mm-hmm. And if we can get past that and say, okay, I need to learn to appreciate some new pleasure and some new patterns here. And the issue is that the more patterns you have access to, the more pleasure you can access, the more capacity to understand the likes and dislikes of others. It's a really powerful tool. We got to want it though. You know, this list is useless if we are
Well, it also reads a bit like homework. And again, it's striking me that, so this year, Everything Everywhere All at Once ran away with the Oscars, right? Armful. Best picture, best actress. And that was structurally a very different kind of movie. And, you know, Americans like their stars, right? And when you have an Asian cast, you know, it's science fiction, but it's not. And it's this. And it, I mean, where did it fit? And it seemed to me that film audiences were much more open to something they hadn't experienced before.
Yeah.
Then just look at the Grammys. You know, Greg and I have no use for the Grammys. I mean, they're chronically 10 or 15 years behind the times. You go back to the 60s, the vaunted 60s. You know, Bob Dylan, the Beatles never won a Grammy until a decade later, right? And it's like, wow, and foodies, like I said, you know, will go to, I'm going to have Mongolian vegetarian cuisine, you know, just because I never have before, right? And they're all excited about that, right? And it's like, man, but so many music lovers. Let me go see Bruce Springsteen again.
There is a book in what you're talking about here, and it is the phenomenon of how institutional power, because the Grammys are an institution, intersects with the cyclical nature of culture and the need, not a bad thing, the need for our industry to make money. Money drives activity. Without making money, there can be less activity. And I think the Hollywood film is an example as well. You look at the history of Hollywood films and there's an ebb and flow. And the ebb is when audiences are less interested. And what happens is the patterns that have become established that used to draw audiences stop working and break, and then new practices emerge and then they become formalized. So, you know, I think we're at that point with music. And again, styles operate on their own trajectories, and it's not going to be universally true, but it might be that what constitutes a hit has been so stable for about 15 years that it's not working anymore. And the Grammys needs to change its taste. It needs to listen past the first 10 seconds to start to observe new patterns and new phenomena and reward those, because it might be that new things will resonate and new things will work. But that's been the case through history. You know, you get this sort of establishing of a set of practices. The practices work. The practices spread. They become dominant. They persist for a period of time, but then they decline. And new practices take their place. So, you know, when J.S. Bach perfected his type of counterpoint, but his sons all rejected it for a simpler, clearer, more clarified, homophonic. That's exactly what's happening with the Grammys. It's a human phenomenon.
Yeah. Continuing with Dr. Tim's list of how you stay listening, how you keep up, find a friend to give you recommendations. Right? Well, that is always, you know, a word of mouth from a friend. I had a sociologist friend who wrote a lot about music and said, you know, they call it socialization in sociology, where nobody is born knowing how to be a member of the Hells Angels or, you know, a street gang, right? You have to be taught the ways of the gang. And, you know, you have a Beatrice, Dante, who leads you into this world, right? And I mean, I vividly remember the friend who first played Wire for me, you know, or the older cousin who said, here, you're going to like this album, Master of Reality by Black Sabbath, right? You know, and nothing connects as powerfully as someone you trust and admire introducing you.
That's right. And this works in terms of individuals, you know, one-on-one relationships where we value each other's opinions. But it also works in an almost not necessarily unhealthy, but if in a peer group, in a sort of adolescent situation, you've got the leader of that group,
the cool one, yeah.
the cool one endorsing a type of music, they are giving permission for all in that group to say, yes, this is okay to listen to. You know, I remember growing up in the 1980s and being quite taken with all kinds of different music, and trust me, a lot of it was not cool. And I found it difficult to share my musical taste with my peers, because I knew enough to know that the sharing of my taste would not be endorsed or rewarded. And I think that set me up well for life, because I've got this sort of eclecticism built in, which I very much value. But nevertheless, you know, if I take it outside the realm of music, if I am sort of shopping for an air conditioner, I don't know the first thing about air conditioners. I don't want to know. I just want to be cold in, you know, summer and warm in winter. Someone I know and trust says, you should go here. That is exactly where I'm going to go. I'm going to take their suggestion seriously. And likewise, if you can have that relationship with when the other suggestions fail, when you can't make it a habit, when you find it difficult to listen past the first 10 seconds, you'll act on what a friend says, because that's what people do. Another useful tool just to, you know, firm up the foundations of trying to keep ourselves still listening.
Finding a critic you trust, or the term everybody likes these days, curator you trust, still has value above and beyond the algorithm.
And the mixtape phenomenon, I'm sure it exists, but I don't know enough about apps. But someone needs to come up with a mixtape app, something that not only creates a playlist, but links it to information about the music, links it to the sort of ephemera that exists around it, and doesn't rely on a particular streaming service. So you can send someone, here's my mixtape for you. Because what a great tool that was. And, you know, maybe the young people share playlists, I don't know. But it's a really useful way of sharing a bit of yourself, but also encouraging diverse listening.
Greg is the king of the mixtapes. He still does one every year. See, I don't have the patience.
Fantastic.
You know, I'm more excited about what I'm going to hear next, always, you know. But Greg likes to sum up each year with the perfect mixtape, and we share it at the end of the year on Sound Opinions. And
it's a great way to form memories. So, yeah. You know, with that kind of tool, you'll be able to think back to 1994, and gosh, you will have a cross-reference of what 1994 represented, because there's this systematic cataloging at work.
It's true, and the 2024 mixtape is as good as the 94 mixtape. All right, keep listening to the music you love, but be willing to revisit long-held beliefs, particularly if you describe your musical taste in the negative, like, I hate jazz. That attitude stifles your joy. I mean, yeah, people who say, I hate polka, I hate jazz, I hate death metal. Like, I can play you some death metal that you may well like, okay? Because, you know, let's face it, I am a music critic, so is Mr. Cott. 90% of everything is either mediocre or sucks, you know, or 90% is just mediocre, right? 5% of everything really sucks. It's so bad, it's noteworthy for being bad, and 5% is brilliant, right? I mean, this is life, right? That's whether we have a meal, whether we're watching television, whatever art form we're exposed to, but to just rule out entire music world seems unduly limiting.
Look, that's right. And, you know, when people say, I don't like opera, I don't like jazz, I don't like country, whatever, you couldn't possibly have heard it all. And that 5% you're talking about, there's a good chance they haven't heard that. There's a good chance they have heard the sort of average country song, or even the country song that others would like to mock. You know, the sort of two chord old fashioned. There's some, you know, you go back in the decades and, you know, you get whistling in the mix. Whistling used to be a thing. And you play those recordings now and they are awkward to listen to. They sound very odd indeed. They are easy to mock. But you got to get past that mockery and look at the best examples. Listen to what's great. The other thing, people are awfully inconsistent. You know, accordions. People say, oh, no, I don't like accordions. And then they'll listen to, you know, Weird Al Yankovic and what's right there in the mix, an accordion. So I think and here's the biggest one of all, don't like classical music. But I will consume orchestral music in large amounts through film scores. And be quite happy to do so. So those beliefs, they're statements of prejudice, and they prevent flourishing. They prevent individuals enjoying their life as much as they could, and they prevent, you know, useful human interaction. You know, when we say this style of music sucks, the conversation ends if you're talking to someone who does like that. And I've never thought that was a particularly useful way to live.
No. Well, and one of the things Greg and I have always loved to do as critics is get people to challenge these canonical beliefs, right? There's no two ways about it. The Beatles had some crappy songs, really bad. You know, and I might say When I'm 64 or Besame Mucho, you know, you might say something else, but it was like the Beatles were God. Nobody was ever as good as the Beatles. Oh, yeah? Let's look at God a little bit. And how much have you ever really listened? I was thinking about Norwegian Wood the other day. I mean, it's a nasty, horrible song. You know, John Lennon doesn't get the romantic assignation that he was anticipating, and so he burns the woman's house down. You know, I used to be cruel to my baby. I beat her and kept her away from the things that she loved, right? There's some nasty, you know, you talk about Eminem and always fantasizing about killing his wife, Kim. Beatles got there first, okay? On the other hand, you know, when a kid says to me, oh, I love the Beatles, I love the Beatles, have you heard this? And then you play Tomorrow Never Knows. And I was like, no, they haven't heard that because that doesn't get played on the radio. And then mind blown, right? So even when you say, I love this, there's things that you haven't thought about that you probably don't love. You never play that album, you know, and there's things that you don't even know that are, you know, I mean, I'd say Tomorrow Never Knows is the Beatles' greatest song.
Now, this is exactly the thing. The radio, and that's obviously not the right word anymore because it's not the radio, it's a whole range of...
Or the algorithm or the stream or whatever, yeah.
But it has a flattening effect. It's like the average of everything. It's not the best. There might be examples of the best, but it's what articulated with the experience of the most number of people. And, you know, if we go forward in time and imagine that this is what the Beatles was or this is what Rolling Stone was, we actually don't get the full story. And there's all kinds of, you know, nuances and you know, details that need to be considered in order to think. So when people say, oh, young people's music today is no good, it's rubbish, they're probably reacting to the average perception, not the corners, which is where the interesting stuff is. And that's why wide listening helps us, you know, learn and understand more. And, you know, there's such opportunity to,
Well, all right. So you end your list, Tim, with what we call here in education in America today, social and emotional learning. You know, if you make a criticism, be sure to give two compliments is the current thinking. Don't feel you have to keep up with all new musical trends. We're 1,000 years, you got 1,000 years of music to explore, right? You're giving people a little bit of a pass there, which is true. I always joke to Greg that when I'm old and retired and no longer have to listen for a living, that's when I'll deal with jazz. Right now, I've got my Mingus, my Coltrane, you know, some Miles Electric, and, you know, I'll deal with the rest of jazz when I have a little time, okay? But don't feel, you know, as long as you're listening, that's good. Especially if you're listening beyond your standard playlist. It can be from 50 years ago, can be from tomorrow.
I wouldn't want people to imagine that the purpose of this list is to get us to a point where everybody likes everything, because that's not a realistic expression of how people work. After having given something a fair go, after having gotten to the point where, all right, I'm familiar with this pattern now, you might still say, there are other things I prefer. And the listening goes off in different directions. The habits and the other sort of helps at work are likely to sort of ensure you find something that you like. But the point we discussed earlier, which was adolescents sometimes don't want us in their space. If the real motivation is I want to form a bridge with my 15-year-old, maybe that bridge needs to be around something else. Because if you're encroaching on someone's space where you're not necessarily welcome, you've got to give them time. So that's the thing. Not every style of music is necessarily going to be in the center of, you know, your listening experience, and that is completely fine.
Yeah, and there's also, it's useful sometimes to have that list of albums. I always say, you know, back in college, I had the records when it was 2 or 3 in the morning and I wanted everybody to go home and they didn't want to end the party. That's when I'd put Captain Beefheart's Trout Mask Replica on, you know, which I love, but...
And look, your comment about jazz, I mean, listening to jazz, not in a sort of quiet lounge room with the, you know, best quality speakers on, but in a jazz club, there might be a little bit of chatter, but you are hearing and you're observing the interplay of the musicians. That goes down very easy. That's very easy to love. But it's quite a different physical experience to putting on a song.
Well, you know, that brings up an interesting point. A buddy of mine in the Paz and Jop poll of annual critics in the Village Voice 30 years ago now wrote that there were two kinds of music critics. There were the listeners at home with the headphones and the stereo, and there were what he called the club rats. And that to see certain music live, you don't really understand or appreciate certain sounds. You know, maybe even the Ramones. You know, the records are okay, right? But they're over in 15 minutes, you know, and that's both sides of an album, you know, but to see the Ramones live and to feel the bass drum in your chest and the, you know, the assault of this jet engine, you don't understand them until you see them live. Do you think that's the case?
Yeah, absolutely. The physicality of some music, the interplay of how the musicians work with each other, whether it's a jazz ensemble or whether it's an orchestra, that human presence and listening to music with others in a large audience setting changes our reaction. The best example I hear is imagine a comedy film. There are comedy films that are not that funny, but in the cinema where you've got a critical mass of people who are out for an evening of entertainment, laughing their heads off. Take that same comedy film and watch it in your lounge room by yourself and you might be entertained, but maybe you don't laugh once. And there is a different set of reactions based on our presence with other people, the desire to clap, the desire to stand and give an ovation, the desire to shout. These things are motivated by the crowd. And so music changes based on how we engage with it, which is why the modes of listening point is so important. For me, I'm in my 40s now, and I think maybe in my 50s I'm going to do this. It's Wagner's Ring Cycle. I know the music. I've listened to it, but I've got to go to a full sitting of the Ring. Now, I don't have the time or the money right now, but one day I have to do that, because only by going to it as intended will I fully appreciate what that represents in terms of a cultural achievement. So that's on my list.
Yeah, but here we have another wrinkle, Tim. You know, I mean, Wagner would be canceled today. You know, I mean, above and beyond the connection with the Nazis, being the favorite music of the Nazis, you know, he was a stone-cold anti-Semite.
Indeed. And, you know, I wrote an article about the Rolling Stones that they'd got very mixed coverage in terms of some ethical choices that I felt they were making later in their career to adapt some of their lyrics. Choices informed by the fact, not that they were selling out or, you know, caving in, but they were saying, okay, our lyrics played one way and impacted people in one way. But now there's this new phenomenon that we are aware of and that people are aware of. And because we own our music and are masters of our own world, we will change our practices. And I thought that was ethical. And here's the thing with cancelling. If we cancel all the bad people's music, then we should start with ourselves. And there won't be anything to listen to once we're done. Because no human is perfect. And
this is
the way
well,
culture...
you know, but that goes back to the point on your list. It helps to know the context. I mean, I think there are very few times we can't separate the artist and the art. You know, for the most part, some awful people make great art and some wonderful people just make boring art and we would have nothing to listen to. However, you know, the R. Kelly canon... And
I think an awareness
two.
Of those cultural issues is important.
Yeah.
And the ethical outworking of that is sort of many and varied. You know, in Australia, the big ethical thing was back in the 1950s and 60s, in order for Australia to it's coming of age. Australia's sort of adolescence in that, you know, cultural time was reflected in let's have music that Australia owns and doesn't sound like British music or doesn't sound like American music. And the way we did it was chucked in a whole bunch of didgeridoos. white people doing that. Now, and they did it in good faith. They thought, yeah, this is a good thing. Not only are we creating a distinct Australian sound, we are highlighting the, you know, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander practices. But it was done with a cloth ear and insensitively, because the moment you learn something about Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander music, you learn that there are permissions and sensitivities around who can play what instrument and how music operates in particular contexts. And you move something out of its cultural setting and you offend people really quickly. And the ethical application is to learn more about each other and to say, okay, I can learn from Aboriginal culture, but I can't just mine it for little token sounds that I would find useful. Ethics in music is a big thing of mine, and it's worth engaging with.
We have been talking to Professor Timothy McHenry from Down Under in Australia, professor of music at the Australian Catholic University. Why do we stop exploring new music as we get older? We shouldn't, is the answer to this question. I love talking to you, Professor.
Thanks very much. No, it's been a great joy.
That is it for this bonus episode. If you've got thoughts on this episode, start a conversation in our Facebook group or leave a voice message on our website, soundopinions.org.
You know, and try not to die before you get old. Somebody said that once. As always, Sound Opinions is produced by Andrew Gill, Alex Claiborne, and our associate producer, Sol Delgadillo. Our social media consultant is Katie Cott. Thanks for listening.